Hello, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, presented by William English. That's me. And today's guest is Clive Philpott, super librarian. having started as librarian at Chelsea Art School and then several years as director of the library at the Museum of Modern Art, New York, and perhaps one of the leading authorities on artists' books in the world, Clive?
There are a small gang of us who perhaps have carved up the territory, but myself and Anne Merglen Delcroix in Paris have a lot of common cause together, and there are others writing in this area too.
Right. And you there was a book, let me see, co-author of Artist Stroke Author Contemporary Artist Books, and numerous other articles, which will be published soon, perhaps?
The text for that, and from early things from the Arts Council, British Council, and so on, are coming together as an anthology of about 50-odd, or at the moment, 50-odd texts, hope to be published next year.
Right, OK. And how did you get into artist books? I mean, what were you doing before the, say, Chelsea, when you were... That was the art school library...
Right. Well, Chelsea, I was working in public libraries, uh-huh. and art was always important to me. And there it was like making exhibitions of children's art and children's poetry and things like that. But I was hungry to get into an art context and was hired at Chelsea, which was terrific.
Yeah.
But the way Artist Books came about was I'd been there for a little while and I realized that the students were very antipathetic to doing, I think it was 15%, art history and complementary studies, and a lot of them resented that. Mm. And they saw the library as part of that apparatus. So I thought, how can I involve them in the library as an entity that has its own way of working and usefulness to them? And I began to become aware of these little, as someone called them, anemic white pamphlets coming out of America, particularly conceptual art documents. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realized you could have art in the library in book form. And I began to do that, and I was hired by Studio International to write a column every month, and it all came together in about 72.
Right. So this is the book as art form.
Right.
And did you develop the library in that direction yourself?
No. And I didn't really, because it seemed to me, while this was very important to me and so on, it was part of the whole apparatus of the library again. Mm. And you had to deal with documenting movements and artists and so on. And this was to the side of that, but it was very important to me and became more and more important. But I never let it distort what the library was about. It seemed to me just part of the library, part of your palette as a librarian, in a sense.
Yeah. But it became quite a significant collection, didn't it? The Chelsea Library particularly, for that kind of documentation.
Right.
Presumably other libraries weren't handling that sort of material.
They hadn't got the awareness of it that grew up at that time with me in certain phenomena. And now, of course, the Tate, which had this material often in various corners, rather like the Museum of Modern Art when I got there, there were books in various corners but not focused. The Tate began to pull this together, and the librarian there was a great friend of mine at the time. We used to exchange ideas. And the two institutions, Chelsea and then MoMA, and the Tate moves along the same path very often.
Mm-hmm. So what period were you at the Museum of Modern Art in New York?
I went over in 77 until 94.
77 to 94.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you, as a result of that, were you curating shows to do with artist books there, or was it still the library rather than an exhibition space?
Well, you were... Like an institution like a museum has various peripheral departments like conservation, library, education. Mm. So in a sense you're peripheral, but all the people in those departments are as committed to art as the curators, but their professional role is different. So I assumed I was hired because of my background, including artist books. Mm. So I went ahead without asking permission to build a collection. And in the time I was there, I think I was never... I never did an artist book collection, exhibition, but I did do a Fluxus exhibition, which grew out of my outside MoMA hours. I used to say that Soho then, as it was, now it's Chelsea, where the phenomenon is, but Soho is my spiritual home, and I spent a lot of hours there, involved in institutions like Printed Matter, the artist bookshop, Franklin Furnace, the archive for artist books, and so on.
Right, right. Well, today we are supposed to be talking specifically about Ray Johnson. Ray Johnson, the significant male artist, M-A-I-L, I should say, as well as being M-A-L-E. And particularly the book and art movement known as flop art. And there's a small book published, well, it's, what should we say, compiled by yourself.
From dialogues I had with Ray.
Right. And this is called Ray Johnson on Flop Art, Fragments from Conversations with Ray Johnson, 1988 to 1994, published in 2008.
By Firmly Press.
Yes. Okay. And we should, I suppose, for people that don't know anything about Ray Johnson or have never heard of him, I suppose we should just sketch in his background. He started, born 1927.
Right.
Died, what, 1994, I think?
1995, just January 95.
95.
Right.
And he was significant for correspondence art, wasn't he? He founded something called the New York Correspondence School.
Someone gave him that name, but as soon as they'd given it to him, he ran with it.
Right.
Became Correspondence, Correspondance School, etc.
Right, right. Okay. And what was his sort of agenda, as it were, with this, with male art? I mean, how did he get into that?
Well, even as a kid, he was a formidable letter writer.
Uh-huh.
And some of his early letters from the 40s have materialized. And one of his old friends there, a guy called Arthur Secunda, who was at high school with him, recently published some of these letters, having some have already been published before, but recently published more.
Right.
So right from the beginning, he was writing letters, orthodox kind of letters, but scattershot, with illustrations, like New Yorker-type illustrations.
Mm.
And then by the time another decade had gone by, he was beginning to do mail-outs of things. He'd got a graphic design practice, working sometimes with Andy Warhol, or Andy Warhol leftovers, Andy Warhol giving things he didn't want sometimes, like doing illustrations for 17 magazine or whatever it might be.
Mm.
And he did these legal size sheets of his craft, his drawing craft, his lettering craft, and put them out as Ray Johnson design. And one could, from that, decide whether you wanted to use this guy as an illustrator, designer, or whatever. He did a lot of book jackets, which are, some of which are still in print.
Mm-hmm.
Rambo poems from New Directions has still got his cover on.
Yeah.
And another one which I've forgotten at the moment.
Mm. And he did, he was sort of, I think his first teacher was Albers, wasn't he?
Yes,
Joseph Albers.
Yes.
And
he had great respect for him when I talked to him in the 80s and 90s. Still had great respect for him.
And that was at Black Mountain College.
Right.
And in fact, there is a new book out, isn't there? There's a book that's just come out called From BMC to NYC, which is Black Mountain College to New York City. The Tutelary Years of Ray Johnson, 1943 to 1967. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, really, given Alba's sort of aesthetic, how Ray Johnson would come out of that, in a way. You can't sort of see the...
The early work of Johnson is somewhat geometric and somewhat Albersian, as he would say. Yes.
Right.
But then he hooked up with the various people who were visiting Black Mountain, like Rauschenberg, not to mention Cage, which is a whole other story.
Right.
And he had a Rauschenbergian phase, and he destroyed most of those at a certain point.
Right.
What's left, what few little pieces I've seen, are really beautiful. Almost monochromatic, some of them, and little surfaces, raised surfaces, reliefs.
Yeah.
Beautiful, seductive thing.
Do you think he... did he have anything to do with George Matunas, do you think?
Because yes.
His career is sort of similar, isn't it? As a graphic designer and then producing kind of Fluxus Ephemera.
The proto-Fluxus publication called... I can't think
Vitre,
of
was it?
No. Vitre he was in, yes.
All right.
But that was already when Fluxus was pretty much on the way. An anthology.
Oh, yes. Lamont Young.
Beautiful, yeah, he was in there.
Right.
It was like part of that stable of artists from which Fluxus came.
Right.
That publication was almost Fluxus number one.
Right.
Except that it wasn't totally under control of Matunas, but he dictated the look and feel of it and everything.
Yeah, and that was about 1961, I think.
I think you're right, but I can't
something
remember.
Something like, give or take a year.
But I would just come back to the book, Flop Art.
Right.
His choice, his invention of flop art was beautifully done, I think, because he called me and told me he'd invented it. I thought, I'm privileged to hear this news first. Yeah. I may not have been first, but he called me and told me this, and I jotted it down. But flop art places him right between the two areas that people are mostly associating with, Fluxus and Pop.
Mm.
And here he is, distancing himself for both, but embracing both at the same time.
Right.
So people often talked about him as a sort of almost Fluxus artist.
Yeah.
And again, his famous Nothing exhibition was put on by George Matunas when he had a gallery before Fluxus.
Oh,
yes.
Right. Okay. So he was fairly contrary sort of
that's
man?
Exactly the word. Exactly
right.
The word.
Yeah.
And mischievous.
Right.
And funny and
sort of refusing almost any categorization.
Exactly.
Wanting to step sideways all the time,
yeah,
it seems.
Exactly.
Even to the point where I think there is a little video online, which is with you and Chuck Close, and there is this extraordinary sort of scenario where, can you describe this?
Well, Chuck and I were describing the same sequence of events, but our stories didn't tally. So the guy who made this film called How to Draw a Bunny, now available on DVD, spliced us together. So one would say one thing, and then there'd be a variant from the other one. So I would say something, and Chuck would go back. And I think Ray was like that. I was going to say, perhaps prefacing all this, that everyone had their own Ray.
Right.
Because my experience of Ray, my feeling of knowing him, is entirely from telephone conversations over many years and many conversations and in the mail and meeting him only a few times. And this is my Ray, and my Ray begins in 1981 when I met him for the first time. Other people have a Ray from the 60s. It's a different Ray.
All right.
And sometimes I can't quite recognize that Ray.
Right, right.
So I would just say that what you hear from me is how I've received the information from him and given information back and so on.
Yeah. But this thing with Chuck Close, was he going to curate a show?
Yeah.
And
what had happened,
the
museum was trying to open up its collection different ways, and it asked artists to choose from the collection, but basically not add anything, but choose from the collection. And Ellsworth Kelly did one, and Scott Burton did one, and the third one was Chuck Close. And Chuck Close decided to give his a theme. The others had more nebulous themes. But Chuck Close decided to do portraiture. And he'd done this enormous photograph, I think it was a Polaroid or whatever, of Ray. What I've seen is about 3 feet high, maybe bigger than that, four perhaps. And he thought of that, but he also realized that Ray was seriously into portraiture. He used to do silhouettes of people. There's a list of 100-odd people he did silhouettes of. I think he shone a light behind them and drew their silhouette on a piece of paper on the wall. And these silhouettes then morphed into his reliefs later on. So Ray, Chuck was very aware of Ray's interest in the portrait and suddenly thought of his bunny heads. Now, shall I digress quickly into bunny heads?
Yes, fine. Let's hear about bunny heads.
Well, the epistolary part of Ray, the letters morphed into these graphic design flyers and things. Then he started sending things, multiple copies of things around, which were not flyers, and they were not something else. And he would often sign these with a little rabbit head. I would say rabbit at that stage.
Yeah.
Little cute little rabbit head. And then these became to be a bit bigger and slightly more idiosyncratic. And finally, they became a phenomenon their own, which became bigger. And in the around late 80s, I think, they suddenly became black and he would drop out white letters in the middle with a word in the middle or a name in the middle. So the one that Chuck had, which he thought would be appropriate, was a bunny head, black bunny head of Bill de Kooning.
Right.
I say Bill because they said Bill.
Yeah.
And this was sent to MoMA to enter the library collection as a backdoor way of getting it in the museum so that Chuck could borrow it to put in the museum collection show.
Right, right. But wasn't it? Didn't he send you hundreds and hundreds of items?
Well, there's two parts to this story. Okay. One is Chuck's report in the New York Times, another place which has been reproduced many, many times, which says Ray inundated me with material. Not quite true.
Okay.
First of all, he used to correspond with me. It started in 1981. He started corresponding with me. And a typical mailing would be three or four sheets in an envelope. And this went on till I left America. In fact, just after I left America, I got one piece in England, I think, before he died. And meanwhile, he said, apropos and around the time of this Chuck Close show, I was always bugging him to do more books because he's done one or two little books. We did one together, Jean de Buffet Fan Club, beautiful little book that he had done by a printer, carefully chosen type, paper and everything else. But I kept trying to bug him to do a book. And so there was something of the period of doing these graphic design flyers where he did something called A Book About Death. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really a book at all, but people, and even I think of it as a book, but it's really just flyers for a book. So page one would say, send 10 cents for a copy of page one of Book About Death. But there was no page one about Book Death, it's just a flyer.
Right.
So with that in mind, he said, well, perhaps I can do a book about modern art. And so he started sending me pages of a book about modern art with a cover letter to me, which is what Chuck was thinking about. They did start coming thick and fast.
Yeah.
And he was going to do 26 episodes in 26 parts or something like that, with a total of 1,000 or 2,000 pages. But he was blown off course so easily. So we'd got about two sections of 26 mailings together. Then I went on vacation. When I came back, he'd lost the thread.
Right.
So it finished. But at the Museum of Modern Art now is this book about modern art, which is itching to be published, I think.
Right, right.
Now I've lost track of where we started.
Yes, indeed. Well, now we've lost the thread, which is probably quite...
Johnsonian.
As it should be, because...
Johnsonian.
Yeah, indeed. Because one of your stories in the catalogue, I suppose we should mention, he had a big show at Raven Row recently.
Yes, yes.
Which was the inaugural exhibition of the Raven Row Gallery,
yeah.
I think.
Alex Sainsbury came up with this as his first show.
Right,
and it was a knockout, absolute knockout. And like Ray, it sort of deflected the path of where you might go from there. Like,
right.
If you do Ray first, what do you do next?
Right. But one of the stories was that I think when you were in New York, he would contact you, and didn't he have a sort of knack of hopping from one subject to another? I think you described one conversation where it sort of went through about 50 topics in 15
That's
minutes,
right.
And you listed them, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
You've got a sort of... I could recite
them if
absolutely.
You like.
Yeah.
So this is a three-minute conversation at random, and these are the topics that came up. Ben Vautier, A Nothing Festival, Elsa Longhauser, Chuck Phelan, Michael Lowe, A Lumber Party, not slumber, lumber, Brooke Shields, Quincy Jones, the country Holland, Douglas Blau, the brother of Stephen Lieber, the New York Correspondence School, Leon Trotsky, Ellen Johnson, lesbian Eskimos, Boxing Helena, the daughter of David Lynch, a senior citizen, John Cage, Merce Cunningham, Faga Gaga, Rita Bottoms, A Nothing, The Little King, and O Soglo. I mean, you just reeled.
And that was in 3 minutes.
It's real. Yeah.
My God, yeah.
Right.
So he would phone you.
He would say, like, have you heard that Ben Vautier is doing a Nothing Festival?
Yeah.
By the way, I've just done a lumber party with Brooke Shields and so on and so on. It would go like
right.
Just sentences, like I said in that piece, not paragraphs, sentences.
Yeah, yeah. So. Just to get back to this booklet, Ray Johnson on flop art. Flop art seems to be anything that depicts a person reclining on their back. Is that true?
Almost. when he first mentioned it, his classical one was L'Etante Donnée of Duchamp in the Philadelphia Museum,
right.
Where the headless nude is on her back.
Right.
But he also mentioned the painting at the Museum of Modern Art by Rousseau, The Sleeping Gypsy, and there was another one then. And then he did suggest Susanna and the Elders by one of these Midwestern artists, and I said, no, surely she's not lying down. He said, oh, I'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
And then I said, you could have odalisques, and he said, no, they have to be on their back in the submissive pose. So I drew a little drawing and sent it back of a flopped watch from Dali's soft watches. And he said, yes, that's flop art.
Oh, that counted.
Yes.
Okay.
So it didn't have to be people. It could be something flopped.
Yeah.
But this was him elaborating, having pushed himself in between Fluxus and Pop.
Right.
So he suddenly invented this movement that spread out.
Yes.
It took wings.
And what exactly was Buxus then?
Well, if you think about Pop Art and Fluxus, you could have Flop and you could have Puxus.
Oh, yes.
And he was walking in the park near him one day, whether this came before or after Buxus, I'm not sure, but he saw this privet bush and it had a Latin label on it of Buxus, Buxus, Buxus or something. And this is the Latin name, I think, of privet or bush like that.
Oh.
And he either knew it already or he'd played with this idea of Puxus, Buxus, and he took that and he showed me a Polaroid of a nothing bunny head placed in a Buxus bush. And at about that time he said, I will be the Andy Warhol of Locust Valley, where he lived, you know, instant photography and Polaroids.
Yeah. Where he withdrew, I think, to Locust Valley, didn't he, after being mugged in New York?
Almost mugged, yes.
Was he?
The same day Andy Warhol was shot, he was threatened with a knife near his friend Bill Wilson's house, which apparently was a brothel next door, and he'd gone out to get some beer, and he was threatened. 2 days later, Robert Kenney was killed, and he flew in the next few weeks, or a couple of months maybe, to Long Island, and was in a place called Glen Cove for a couple of years, and then Locust Valley.
Right.
Which spawned things like the Locust Valley Biennale and the magazine, not the New Yorker, but the Locust Valleyer. And he would make all these games with Locust Valley.
Right. Yeah. Well, I suppose that brings us to the way his sad demise, I suppose. He apparently swam out to sea, having planned his sort of suicide.
It would seem so. It's very difficult to be quite sure about this, and I hate to speak of the intentions of someone who's dead, because I think we can't know.
Right, sure.
But it would seem, on the surface at least, that he alerted several people in different ways to, I think one of them was a big nothing, I'm going to do a big nothing.
Uh-huh.
And someone else, he said, you wanted to do something with me for a long time, well, instead of a nothing, you're going to get a something. And other indications that he might be contemplating some drastic move.
Right.
And what happened was he was on Long Island, like I said, in Locust Valley, and he drove all the way up to the end, pretty much, to, can't remember the name, and he rented a room in a motel, and the room happened to be a number that added up to 13, which is part of the understory of this. He was 67, which adds up to 13.
Right.
It was the 13th of January, 1995, and people have seen all this.
I think it was even a Friday, wasn't it? Was it Friday?
I can't remember.
I think it was. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And so people who are into that sort of thing made a real mess of all this, seems to me. It's like whether he did or didn't. He was aware of numbers. Numbers were important to him and things like that. But he went out in the evening, I think, yes, in the evening, and apparently jumped off a bridge and swam out to sea. Two girls heard this happen and more or less witnessed it. I don't know if it was seeing it or hearing it or both. And as the Village Voice said, the headline was backstroking to oblivion, words like that. And he backstroked out to sea. And the next morning he apparently was washed ashore on his back with his arms crossed like a mummy almost and dead.
Right.
And there was no will, there was no last will and testament, nothing like that. And so eventually friends and the police had to break into his house. And when they got there, there was nothing on the walls. Everything else was boxed up. The only thing that was visible was on the next floor up, which was a photograph of Ray looking at you from the top of the stairs. Everything else had been packed up.
All right.
So it was certainly premeditated.
Right.
And I guess you can only assume it was suicide. Well, it was suicide, I'm sure. But
yeah.
To make bigger claims for it, I think you just can't know what was going on in his mind.
Right. But his reputation has actually probably grown in stature over the last few years, hasn't it? He's becoming sort of... quite a major figure now, I think.
With him out of the way, people could do what they like with his legacy.
Right.
I say that rather cavalierly, but he prevented exhibitions of his work.
Oh, really?
He would not do this. There were only two exhibitions in the last maybe 15 years or something like that, both at public institutions. The person who looks after his estate, Richard Feigen Gallery, people there pestered him, and I say pestered him, asked him for several years, like, we want to do a show, we want to do a show. He wouldn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
But he would concede to do two shows, the second one, which I was involved with in Philadelphia, and was included this book about modern art, as he was, at one time, that was going to be the show, but he added other things to that.
Right.
So now he's dead. His real achievement can be evaluated, and his last works are marvelous. I could spend time with the last few years of his works. Shall I say more? Or
I'm afraid we are now approaching the end of the programme. So thank you very much to Clive Philpott.
Thank you too.
For talking about Ray Johnson, mostly. And Clive's book, Ray Johnson on Flop Art, is available from good bookshops.
Only good ones. Right.
Thanks very much, Clive. Thank you.
Thank you too.
By looking at a tree, you can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge a daughter by looking at the mother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, come on in closer, baby. Hear what else I gotta say. You got your radio turned down too low. Turn it up. Looking at the king, you can't judge a woman by looking at her man. You can't judge a sister by looking at her brother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see? Oh, you misjudged me. Well, I look like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover, come on. Looking at the cover, oh, can't you see? Oh, can't you see? Ain't like a farmer, but I'm a lover. Can't judge a book by looking at the cover.